Galatians again. If you didn't get a handout on your way in this morning, raise your hand. We want to make sure everybody got one. If you didn't get a handout on the way in, Brother Dustin will make sure you do get one. Anybody? No? We got everybody? I think so. Awesome. Well, we're going to be in Galatians chapter 4. I have no idea how long my Sunday school lesson is going to last. I got my wisdom teeth taken out on Thursday, and so I haven't actually talked for this long straight since then. So this is going to be an experiment that we're all going to try together. But the message today is intended. It is in some ways it's complicated. In other ways, it's not. It's intended to serve as an illustration in order to help us understand everything he's been talking about. However, at first glance, the passage actually seems extremely confusing. But the point of it is to take the confusion and minimize it. So we're going to look at that today. Galatians chapter 4. We're going to be doing the rest of this chapter, which means we are leaving today the whole doctrinal section in the middle of this book. So the deeper and more complicated and the more wordy parts of this book are going to be finished off with today. So we're looking forward to that. This book is about the gospel. It is about Paul's defense of the definition of and his ability and authority to preach the gospel. And he has defined it simply as if we have received justification, we've received acceptance by God and are counted righteous by faith and not by the works of law, then we also continue in our acceptance before God by faith and not by the works of the law. And he uses, throughout this book, he contrasts law with promise, law with works, works of the Spirit with the works of the flesh. And he puts those two together. It's my ability to earn God's favor or God's righteousness applied to my account. He uses as the greatest example Abraham. And he has three illustrations about Abraham in this very, very short book. We've already seen two of them. The first one is about how Abraham was saved. He was counted righteous in the first place in Genesis chapter 15 by faith before the works of the law even came. Additionally, he was given the promise in Genesis chapter 12, not because he had earned it, but he was given to it, and all Abraham had to do was receive it. And Paul is not minimizing goodness and righteousness. What he's minimizing is our goodness and our righteousness and our ability. He goes in this last passage, he talks about how going back to law is going back to the base way of how we thought. He compares the law to idolatry in the extent that both of them are operating on the mindset, if I do enough things in the right order enough times, then I will earn the favor of God, or I'll earn the favor of the gods. And he says, that's all a base way of thinking. It comes from the same mindset, and it's all a failure. He calls it weak and beggarly. He's defined in this book that the law is not bad. The law is not evil, because it tells you to do good things, or at least it tells you to do fine things. But it is weak, and it is powerless, and it is poor, because it is built upon our ability to fulfill it. And so the law is weak and powerless and poor because we are weak and powerless and poor. And therefore, we need somebody else's goodness to be applied to our account if we're going to be accepted before the throne of God. And so he says we have to receive it. We do not earn it. We receive it by faith. And so he has been using this whole section. He's been defining all of this throughout this book. He talks about how giving them the truth has somehow made people their enemies, which exposes the fact that religion is often based on what men think and not on the truth of the gospel. And he's going to give one more illustration before he's done. This passage is going to seem very complicated, but it's not intended to be. So rather than reading the whole section, I want us to walk through it piece by piece. Most of my message is actually in the introduction, so don't get scared. The whole message he gives is in the basic story that he provides. And so I'm going to do that and lay the groundwork, and then we'll just add some points there at the end, okay? So look down to verse number 21. So he starts, he says, "Tell me, ye that desire to be under the law, do ye not hear the law?" Now, by the way, throughout the Bible, the word the law, the phrase the law, is used in a couple different ways. Sometimes the law means the law of Moses, the law that Moses received from God on Mount Sinai and gave to the people. Sometimes the law just refers to all the books that Moses wrote, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And actually, he uses it in both those ways in this verse. So he says, you guys who want to go back to all the systems of ritual and religion that Moses received from Mount Sinai, he says, well, let's open the books of Moses and see what it tells us. So that's what he says there. Verse number 22. For it is written, Abraham, so this is the third illustration of Abraham, had two sons, the one by a bondmaid, the other by a free woman. But he who was of the bondwoman was born after the flesh, he of the free woman was by promise. Now, by the way, Abraham didn't have only two sons. It's not what he's trying to claim here. After Sarah's gone, he marries a wife in a brief story. It's hardly even a story. He marries a woman named Keturah. He has a few other boys with her. That's not the point. He's not claiming he only had two sons. But what he's saying is, especially this story, there are two children that are going to serve as his illustration of these two ways of thinking. One by a free woman, one by the bond woman. One was born of the flesh, the other one was born by promise. This is a lengthy story and would take us a long time to read the whole thing. If you're curious, I would encourage you to go back and read it yourself. I gave you the passages in Genesis 16 and 17 and also in chapter 21 where the story kind of fleshes out. This is what happens. Abraham is given the promise that he, through his seed, would bless all the nations in Genesis chapter 12. And he follows that. He accepts that. He doubts it a little bit later on in Genesis chapter 15, like, God, I have no children. I can't bless all the nations through this abundant seed I'm supposed to have if I don't have any children at all. But God says, no, I promise you, your descendants will be as the sand of the sea. They'll be as the stars of the sky. Genesis chapter 15, Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him for righteousness. And we've already quoted that in this book. That was the basis upon which he was accepted, not because Abraham could do or produce any righteousness, but because he received it. Okay. However, Abraham realizes that this promise of God is not going to work with his own power. He's old. He can't have kids. So this is really important. God promised him something that he would do in him. And Abraham said, I can't do that. So we're going to have to figure out a way that I can do it. So he has a bond slave whose name is Hagar. Good or bad, and it's not good, but that's just the way it was set up. And part of the way it being set up by her being part of that household, if he had a child by her, that child would be the heir of Abraham and Sarah, legally. And they were like, okay, so we can work this out. God gave us this promise, and I'll receive that God can do this promise, but because I can't see how we can do it in our power, I'll just try my best to make it work anyway. So he had a child by Hagar, whose name was Ishmael. Well, what's funny is they have a conversation later, and Abraham says to God, and he says, let Ishmael be the heir. And God says, no. The heir is going to be through you two, you and your wife, your actual wife, Sarah. Remember the story that the three men come and they visit Abraham in the tent, and they tell Abraham, Sarah will have a son. And they laugh because it's ludicrous to think that they could do that. Because it is ludicrous to think that they could do that. Because they were incapable in the power of their own flesh to produce the promises that God had given to them. We see the connection of why Paul might be using this story. So through the power of their own flesh, they tried to make it work anyway by having a son through Ishmael. And so Sarah does eventually have a son, Isaac, because God gave her the power to do that. So the seeds of the gospel here are given in the covenant of Abraham. All the nations of the earth will be blessed through them. However, he could have given that promise to anyone that could have children. That wouldn't have been miraculous at all. He could have given that promise to a 35-year-old who's married to a 30-year-old wife, and then they have kids, and then they become a great nation, and all the promises would have taken place, and that would have been fine. But God doesn't do that. He chooses to give the seeds of the gospel. I am going to bring the redemption to all mankind through your family. And he gives it to a man who can't have one child. Why? Because he wants, at the very beginning of the gospel story as it's sent out to the world, he wants people to see automatically, at the beginning, at the onset, we can't do it in the power of our own flesh. Yet, we will try to do it in the power of our own flesh. So that's the story. We know the story. Maybe you don't, but now you do. I just told it to you. You can go back and read it later. So what does Paul do with this story? A little bit more than we might be expecting. Look at verse 24. So he read his short remembrance of the story, and the reason why I said we should know this is because actually Paul, he structures this whole passage around the assumption that you know the story as well. Look at verse 24. He says, which things, the things he just talked about, are an allegory. Now, pause. I don't want to make a really long, drawn-out explanation about that, because I could, but I'm not going to. Suffice it to say, Paul is not claiming that Abraham and Sarah and Hagar, the story never happened. Pilgrim's Progress is an allegory. Christian, he goes out of the city of destruction, and he finds himself in the Slough of Despond on his way to the Wicket Gate, but goes up aside to the city of morality, and he climbs the mountain difficulty. He meets giant despair. He goes through Vanity Fair. None of that happened. It didn't happen. It's a picture of our Christian life. Okay. However, when Paul says the word allegory here, he's not saying that Abraham and Sarah and Hagar, the story never happened. Neither is he saying that what he's about to do from this passage is what we should have been seeing all along. Like, I didn't see any of what he's about to say. No, we didn't. If you turn to Genesis, and I were to preach from Genesis 16, 17, and 21, there's all kinds of sermons that can come out of that. However, Paul is going to use the story as an illustration of what he's talking about. So that's what he means by allegory. This pictures to us what I'm talking about, Paul says. Okay, let's move on. Which things are an allegory? For these are the two covenants. The one from Mount Sinai, which gendereth bondage, which is Agar, or Hagar, which is the bondslave of Abraham, who he had Ishmael through. So what Paul does here is he takes the story of Hagar and Sarah and says that it is like the decision that the Jews are making right now. The covenant that he's referring to, he's already used the term covenant before, refers all the way back to the Abrahamic covenant, that God would bless all the nations freely, regardless of how, regardless of their abilities. Abraham didn't earn that power, and neither would anybody else. They would receive it. That is the covenant that he's referring to. He's talked about that in chapter 3 already. He says, but the other agreement that I've made, which is the one from Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai is where the children of Israel went to in the desert out after they left Egypt, where they received the law of Moses, which told them, do this, don't do this, do it this way, and don't do it this way. The Jews at this point, remember, were trying to earn God's favor and declare themselves good by doing all the law. But throughout this book, we've already learned that though the law is not evil or bad, it does not produce the promises of God or righteousness because it relies on my power to do it. And the law is weak and powerless and poor because I am weak and powerless and poor. And so to appeal to Mount Sinai is to do what Abraham did when he went to Hagar. This is what he's saying. He says, I want to be accepted before the throne of God. I want the promises of God to work in my life. How is it going to work? I don't know. It's not in me. So I'll do it my way anyway and make it happen. It says, Hagar is like Mount Sinai. Now look what he says in verse 25. For this Agar is Mount Sinai in Arabia. By the way, I think he throws in the Arabian mention because the descendants of Ishmael eventually went to Arabia. So he's trying to connect those together. And answereth to, which literally means it's connected to, it's in the same line as, Jerusalem, which now is, and is in bondage with her children. So he goes on to say that Mount Sinai, the law, has turned into Jerusalem, which is the locus of Jewish religion. And what has it produced? Slavery. They're slaves to the law. They weren't even free people. They were slaves to Rome. The Jewish people, through the power of their flesh, throughout all these hundreds of years, trying to keep the law, have not brought about righteousness or the promises of God. They have, like Abraham, heard the good things that God wants to do in them, and they tried to make it happen without his power working in them. He says, that's what you're doing. The Jews, from Mount Sinai to Jerusalem, are being Abraham, going to Hagar to try to have the promises of God the way that we can make it work, rather than receive the promises of God in his power. Timothy George says this, just as Hagar and Ishmael were both slaves, so also were all those who sought to be made right with God on the basis of the law observant system, centered in Jerusalem in a state of spiritual servitude. However, the opposite of that, verse 26, but Jerusalem, which is above, is free, which is the mother of us all. Jerusalem, which is above, not the Jerusalem which is now, not the Jerusalem that they see in Israel, not the one that was a center of Jewish religion. He says the Jerusalem which is above, the heavenly city, the kingdom of heaven, God's throne. Jerusalem which is above is free. Mount Sinai and all of that, the law, Jerusalem, the center of Jewishness, he didn't appeal to that. He looked for the kingdom of heaven. He looked to the throne of the Messiah. He looked to Jesus, who is our Savior. And he says this, so to receive the promises of God in our life, we don't look to a place, we don't look to a people, we don't look to a religion, we look to a person, which is Jesus Christ. That's what Abraham did. Look at the book of Hebrews. I gave it to you in your passage, Hebrews chapter 11. By faith, he sojourned in the land of promise as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. But he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. And then it goes on talking about how Sarah, by faith, received the promise with Isaac. And so in this passage, what he does is he draws two columns of ways of thinking. He takes an old story. Abraham was given promises. God was going to work in him to reach people, to accept people, to redeem people. And Abraham could have trusted that God's power would do it in him, but said, no, my power has to do it. And he went and had a son with Hagar, Ishmael. Instead, later, he had a son, Isaac. And the promise did not go through both of them. And Paul brings out the story to say, you, Galatians, are doing the same thing. You have been given the promises of God, that God will accept you by faith, and yet you said, no, I have to work it my way. And you go to law, Mount Sinai, you go to religion, Jerusalem, instead of looking to me, looking to heaven, and asking for my power to do it in you. That's the whole message. So, here's a couple truths that I think we can gain from this. I'll give you five truths about the promises of God gained in our own power, and then we'll be done. That's the whole message he gives. It's here to wrap it up in a neat little bow. He hasn't said anything brand new in this passage. He's already given this whole doctrinal section, and he's just said, we want to talk about Abraham, we want to talk about the father of promise. We're making the same decisions he made when he went to Hagar, trying to make God's promises work in our own flesh. And he says it doesn't work. So here's a couple truths. Number one, finding acceptance by the law is trying to gain the promises of God in the flesh. Trying to gain the promises of God in the flesh. Finding acceptance by the law is trying to gain the promises of God in the flesh. Paul takes his whole book and he says, Hagar's like Mount Sinai and present-day Jerusalem. And he says in verse 23, and he says in verse 29, that like Ishmael, it is born after the flesh. Now, we use the term flesh in our vernacular, which is fine because the Bible uses it this way as well. When we use the word flesh, we usually mean sinful desires. That's what we mean. It's what my old man wants. And that's fine because that's true, but that's not the only way that the Bible uses the word flesh, because Paul almost doesn't use it that way most of the book. Most of the book, he uses the word flesh to mean this: our earthly human efforts to produce things that are only spiritually possible through the power of God. So the problem is not that we're not doing good things. The problem is that not that the Jews were bad to want to obey law. The problem is not that the Jews were from Jerusalem. And the problem certainly wasn't that they were trying to do all the rituals that God told them to do. The problem was that they thought that they could, in the power of their own flesh, produce goodness from their hearts. And the purpose of the law was to show them that was not possible. And yet here they are trying to do it themselves. The problem was not that Abraham wanted to have a child and for God to bless his family. The problem was he tried to produce that child in his own flesh. And so he went to Hagar. The problem for us is not that we do good things. It's not that we go to church. The problem is not that we look like Christians. The problem is when we say, I am counted good because I am good, because I've done enough good things. The problem is that we don't receive it by faith. We try to produce it in flesh. Remember Galatians 3? Are you so foolish? Having begun in the spirit, are you now made perfect through the flesh? Timothy George says this: the birth of Ishmael was the result of the outworking of the philosophy that God helps those who help themselves. Religion is the idea that you're already good, you just got to pull it all out. The gospel reminds you that's not true. And religion tries to do it anyway, through the power of our own flesh. Number two, gaining the promises of God in the flesh is stepping backward into bondage. Backward into bondage. Go back and look at verse 22 and 23. For it's written, Abraham had two sons, the one by a bondmaid, the other by a free woman. But he who was of the bondwoman was born after the flesh, and he of the free woman was by promise. Go down to verse 25. This Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia, an answer to Jerusalem, which now is and is in bondage with her children. Now, there's a lot of cruelty in the whole idea that the whole slavery system even existed in its varying ways. Slavery is not exactly the same throughout all of history, and we can't copy and paste one on the other. But it's definitely not the ideal system that people are literally subject to other people or owned by other people legally. That's not the point of Paul's message. Paul's message here is not to justify or to condemn slavery. Paul's point was there was slavery, and when Abraham appealed to the flesh, he ended up going toward slavery instead of toward freedom. He was the husband of, his wife was, a free woman. They would have had a free child. But instead, he chose to go toward the slavery and have a bond child instead. And he says, likewise, Jews, when you go to your own efforts, you end up stepping into slavery. Now, I'm not going to keep on producing this message again because he's already been talking about this all the way throughout this book. Now, what's really fascinating, though, about this, by the way, our fellows are going to come by. Take your attendance slip and drop it in. We'd appreciate this. Now, think for a second. You're a Jew for a moment, okay? All of you are Jewish. I have dubbed you so. Think about this illustration for a second. Think about how flabbergasted they would have been when Paul just did this to them. The Jews prided themselves on being the special people of God, right? They were the people of promise. They were the children of Abraham. They were the children of Isaac, right? So that was important to them, their heritage, their lineage. What Paul does here is fascinating. He goes back to some of their own roots and says, but guys, when you appeal to your flesh to try to earn favor with God, you're acting more like not the children of Isaac, the children of promise. You're acting more like the children of flesh. You are more children of Ishmael than you are children of Isaac. And he completely turns their world upside down. Jews thought they earned being part of the promises of God. And he says, no, when you try to do that, you're actually putting yourself outside of that lineage, not inside of it. And he says, you're going away from the freedom that I want for you. And you're stepping toward bondage. Remember, look at verse 28. I didn't actually read this one yet, so you don't remember. Verse 28. Now we, brethren, as Isaac was, are the children of promise. We. He looks at the Jews, the actual children of Isaac, and says, you're not acting like children of Isaac. You're acting like children of Ishmael. And he looks at them. He looks at Galatians, Gentiles, people who are more likely to be children of Ishmael. And he says, when we receive it by faith, we're not children of Ishmael, we're children of Isaac, because we are following the promises, not the flesh that we can produce. This is where he goes into the very beginning of his next section. Look at verse number 1 of Galatians 5. Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free, and be not entangled again with the yoke of bondage. Remember, we just finished the section at the beginning of the book. When we go to law, we are slaves. But when we go to gospel, we receive adoption of sons. And when we go back to law, we go back to slavery instead of receiving the position that God has granted us as his children. Number 3, stepping backward into bondage has no place in the gospel promise of the church. Stepping backward into bondage has no place in the gospel promise of the church. So he says in verse 30, nevertheless, what saith the scripture? Cast out the bondwoman and her son, for the son of the bondwoman shall not be heir with the son of the free woman. Now the whole story there, Hagar and Ishmael are sent out after Isaac is born. And there's a whole sad story with that. And we can preach a message about how God met with Hagar in the desert and he was there and he took care of them anyway. That's a different note. This is the single point that Paul's trying to bring out. The promises of God and the heir of Abraham wasn't going to go through Isaac and through Ishmael. It can't go through both. It wasn't going to go through what child God gave to them and what child Abraham manufactured on his own. It wasn't going to go to both. And it didn't go to both. The promises didn't go through Isaac and through Ishmael. And the problem is, that's what the church tries to do, doesn't it? We try to mash those two systems of thinking together. We try to have gospel where we aren't good enough on our own, and the only way to be accepted before God is through his power. And yet, we can be so laced with religion and says, but I must do enough in order for God to accept me, and I earn his favor. And we try to smash them together, and we try for all the promises of God to come through Isaac and through Ishmael at the same time. You cannot do that. We cannot have both. Stepping backward into bondage has no place in the gospel promise of the church. Number four, rejoicing can come from the freedom of reliance on God's power in spite of my weakness. Rejoicing can come from the freedom of reliance on God's power in spite of my weakness. So go back a couple verses. Look at verse 27. For it is written, he says, rejoice thou barren that bearest not. Break forth and cry, though thou travailest not, for the desolate hath many more children than she which hath an husband. So here, Paul quotes a passage from Isaiah 54. Isaiah gets really complicated sometimes. Right in this passage of the book of Isaiah, Isaiah is picturing Jerusalem in a figurative way. Jerusalem is about to go into captivity. He's promising that Well, he's promising the northern captivity of Israel. He's promising the future captivity of Jerusalem because of their sin. He's picturing the city of Jerusalem as a widow who has no husband and has no sons. Nobody to take care of her. Sitting by the gate and weeping. And he tells her in this passage, in this figure, because by the way, Jerusalem at that point was going to go into captivity. They had lost. They had failed. Everyone had abandoned them. They would have nothing. You remember my Jeremiah message. That's how a lot of those passages felt. So it's a very sad moment. The idea that God's precious city, Jerusalem, would be so utterly desolate because of its own decisions. But he looks at her and he says, rejoice and break forth and cry. I'll read the passage. This is where he gets it. Isaiah 54:1. Sing, O barren, thou that didst not bear. Break forth into singing and cry aloud, though thou didst not travail with child. For more are the children of the desolate than the children of the married wife, saith the Lord. Why are they singing? In spite of the fact that they are desolate. What are they to sing for? What are they to rejoice about? Everything in their lives are falling apart. Why does Paul quote this verse here? Of all things to pull out and dump in the middle of Galatians. Well, the point that Isaiah is making in this passage is that in spite of the fact, because this is what prophets did all the time, they looked at the immediate problems and then they pointed forward to future hope. But the hope always came from Messiah. It came from God's power. It came from God's mercy. It came from God's restoration. They, in the power of their own flesh, countless times, book after book after book after book through the Old Testament, in the power of their own flesh, they failed. But they could hope in the goodness of God. They could hope in the mercy of God. They could hope in Messiah coming. They could hope in somebody else's goodness being good for them. And they could look towards that. And Paul pulls that passage out. I read verse 1. I want you to look at verse 5. How can he look at desolate Jerusalem and tell them to rejoice? Look at verse 5 of that passage in Isaiah. For thy maker is thine husband, the Lord of hosts is his name, and thy redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, the God of the whole earth shall he be called. They could rejoice for the future, not because they had produced goodness, not because they had restored themselves. They could rejoice for the future because God would redeem them through his power. And so Paul pulls out that passage from Isaiah and dumps it in here in the passage about Abraham and Sarah and Hagar and says, do not rejoice because you can restore yourself. Rejoice because, remember Isaiah, because God's power can work in you. Timothy George says this, whatever the precise nuance intended by Paul in his citation, this Old Testament text, the burden of his message is clear. The great reversal envisioned by Isaiah from barrenness to fruitfulness, from despair to joy, from desolation to blessing, can only be accomplished by the unilateral intervention of God himself. So why do I say that? Why does Paul put this here? Religious people can't truly rejoice. Why? Because they are barren and incapable, and they know it. Remember last week I read from Revelation chapter 3? You say I'm rich and increased with good, but knowest not that thou art desolate and miserable and poor and blind and naked. Religiousness desperately tries to achieve what it can't and only sees failure week after week and day after day and year after year. Their hearts don't produce righteousness, so what do? They wear it on the outside. You know, like the Pharisees, they were whited sepulchers, which indeed appeared beautiful on the outside, but inside were dead men's bones. They made broad their phylacteries and enlarged the borders of their garments. Why? Because they weren't righteous on the inside, so they had to paste righteousness onto the outside. But Jesus sees through us. And so what do they have to rejoice about? Nothing. But laughter and joy, Isaac, comes when we just accept that the only goodness that we will ever have, the only power that we will ever have, is in God, who is in us, working and forming Christ in us. Go back a couple verses. Look at verse number 19 of Galatians 4. Remember this? My little children, of whom I travail in birth again until Christ be formed in you. What's coming out of us is not our old selves that we just had to manufacture. Some new churches today, they actually preach that. I've heard a few clips. God doesn't make you, I literally heard one of them say this, God doesn't make you a new creature, he just reveals who you've been all along. Wow, where have you been, man? Because that's a really nice thing to think. The problem is, religiousness kind of thinks that way. If I do enough, I can pull it out of me. Well, it's never been in you. It's never been in you. You never produce it. You never have. You never will. Not before you were saved, not after you're saved. The only thing that produces in it is the presence of Christ and us receiving it and instantiating it by faith. Only time it has ever worked. Now, number five, and I'll be done. One little side note, just as we finish. Those who follow law and religion will still persecute those who do not. Will still persecute those who do not. Look at verse 29. But as then he that was born after the flesh persecuted him that was born after the spirit, so it is now. So there is a brief mention why Ishmael, he was about 13 years older? I think that's right. 13 years older, that's right, okay. 13 years older than Isaac. So Isaac's born, favorite child, the child of promise, and there's a brief mention in passing that Ishmael and his mother, they mocked at Isaac. And here he brings out this story from the story he's been talking about. He says, so the one who is born after the flesh persecutes the one who is born after the spirit, and hey, the same is true today. Today's Ishmaels, the children of those trying to produce goodness and promises of God in their own efforts, persecute the Isaacs, those who are a product of God's power and not their own, and just rejoice in it. In Paul's ministry and his early missionary journeys, especially the first one, Paul was persecuted. He was stoned. He was thrown out of town by Jewish people, primarily by Jewish people. At least in the missionary journey just prior to writing this book. How is that even possible? Why would the most religious people in the world be the ones that persecuted the gospel message the most? Because aren't they the closest in thinking? According to Paul, they're not. They should be in the same lineage where we learn the lessons we learned to bring us to Christ. But instead of learning the lessons that they were supposed to learn, they learned or tried to learn that we could do it on our own and actually went the opposite direction and thought the opposite way. And the religion of the Jews became not just a precursor to Christianity, became opposed to it. And he says, just as Ishmael persecuted Isaac, so it is now. I mean, just earlier in this chapter, am I become your enemy? Because I told you the truth. Religion became an enemy of truth. You realize this is the first murder that happened in the Bible, right? Adam and Eve have Cain and Abel. They both bring a sacrifice to God. Abel brings the sacrifice he's supposed to by the blood of somebody other than him, and he sacrifices a lamb. Cain doesn't do that. Cain produces a sacrifice of the work of his own hands, and he brings vegetables and fruits and sacrifices it, and God does not accept it. He would accept it if Cain did well. If you do well, then I'll accept what you do. But this is the work of your own hands. What does Cain do in response? He could have recognized his bad thinking, or he gets mad at the one who's accepted before God, and he chooses the latter. Cain's response by his sacrifice not being the basis upon which he could be accepted before God became the foundation for him persecuting the one who was. Why is that the way that we think? I think it's primarily because that's the only way that we can cope with the bad thinking that we have. Religious people can be nasty people, can't they? And to be fair, a lot of them think that they might be holding to the truth when they emphasize law. But I think a lot of it is spiritual frustration. that's inherent in the heart of a man who is trying to produce righteousness, and he's trying to make the unconditional promises of God effective in his own life, in the power of his own flesh, rather than just humbly receiving it by faith. But he knows that he cannot, because while he appears beautiful on the outside, he knows that inwardly he's filled with dead men's bones. And so they cope with the frustration by pointing out that everyone around them is not filled with law enough, which means that they are superior, which means that even though I know the goal of being made right before the throne of God is unattainable through the power of my own flesh, at least I'm closer than that guy because I just declared to everybody that he's not as good as me. And so it is now. The Ishmaels persecute the Isaacs. They spend their lives tearing everyone else down as if it makes them more holy. And that's what religion does. That's what happens when we appeal to the powers of our own flesh. Even with the good intentions of doing right, we try to produce something that we cannot make, which is opposed to the gospel itself. And so, he concludes these last two chapters in one little statement. Verse 31. So then, brethren, we are not children of the bondwoman, but of the free. This is the conclusion of this whole section. We are children of the promise of the blessing of Abraham, sons and heirs of Abraham by faith, just like Abraham received it by faith, in his seed, which is Christ. It is not through the impotence of the law and self-sufficiency, which only shows our weakness and brings slavery, but is rather through faith, which can produce joy and can produce liberty. And so he finishes his doctrinal section to try to convince us that it never has been, not at the beginning of the Bible and not at the end, we have never been able to make the righteousness of God from our own hearts. We have only received it by faith. And when we do, we are opposed to the gospel. When we try to receive it by the works of our flesh, we are opposed to the gospel itself. And so now what he's going to do in chapters 5 and 6 is he's going to apply this to our everyday life. What does that mean tomorrow for you and me? And he's going to talk about how that works out in our Christian life. At this point, and I said last week, we are kind of under the impression that, hey, Paul's saying that it doesn't matter what we do. Paul's not saying that. But he's trying to define where good things come from. And so if I know where the good things come from, not from me, but from Christ, then I can actually see it working out in my life. But when I try to produce good things from a source that has no good things, I don't get good things. And that's what he's going to talk about in this next chapter. So stay tuned, and we will bring that up next week.